Hello, my name is Andrew Perriman. I am an Associate Research Fellow at London School of Theology, among other things, and I am the author of this book, In the Form of a God, The Pre-Existence of the Exalted Christ in Paul.
Dr. Andrew Perriman, welcome back to part two of this conversation about your excellent book, really interesting book called In the Form of a God, The Pre-Existence of the Exalted Christ in Paul. It's part of the Studies in Early Christology series, a series that I edited along with Mike Bird and Scott Hauerwerb. Thank you for sticking around for part two.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I mean, this is such an important book, I think, in a lot of ways, because you're going against a consensus and you're raising some really interesting issues and not fully persuaded at any particular point necessarily, but think that it's definitely a book that we've got to consider as we think about, does Paul think about the exalted Christ in some sense as pre-existence to his human life, right? So that's one of the key questions. Some scholars have answered that, yes, but you're answering it a little bit different way, and we'll let you unpack that in a few minutes. But in this part of the interview, I want to talk about, in particular, the Philippian hymn, Philippians 2, 6 through 11. We're going to focus primarily on that first part, 6 to 8 in there. Thank you for sticking around.
Yeah. I think it's just verse 6, isn't it, that we're going to focus on?
It really is, yeah.
It gets narrower, smaller, and smaller.
But you know, that's just part of the story, right? I mean, in talking about the grand narrative, I think Mike Gorman refers to this as the master story of Paul at some point. So Philippians 2, 6, let me read it from the ESV. Who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. Now, that's an important passage. Because a lot of people look at that and say, well, he's referring to here the pre-existent Christ. Yep. So how do you see this particular passage?
Yeah, okay. Where do we start? It's being in the form of en morphe theou. There's no obvious sense in that immediate grammatical reason for saying this is the God of whom Paul served.
Right.
One God who created the heavens and earth. I think we can in principle translate it in the form of a God. And that's where I end up. The key, certainly the first part, the first question is this word morphe, and how is that likely to have been understood? Writing effectively within a Gentile context, he's not a letter that's addressed to Jews, but in any sort of obvious sense, certainly the assumption that this is something that needs to be understood by Gentiles. This word morphe, there's four chapters of this the book, and scholars have gone to enormous lengths to try and show how Paul or whoever wrote this little passage could have used that with reference to the God of Israel, the one God, the God who created the heavens and the earth. And what I tried to do there is show that you simply can't do that. It's just very unlikely that a Jew would have used this word morphe in reference to the one God. By contrast, if you read the pagan literature, they're talking all the time about the forms of the gods or the forms of godlike people. It's a very natural expression to use. How do the gods appear? They appear in human form. Mm-hmm. And it's the word, I think, pretty much always and probably always refers to the external appearance of something. You can't argue, I don't think, that it refers to something inward and invisible or some quality such as glory or something like that. The other thing, I mean, we could stop me if I'm jumping around too much.
No,
the other
argument that's helpful.
Made is that morphe is effectively in here equivalent to icon. The man created in the image of God. So I don't think that argument works either. Well,
that was Jimmy Dunn's perspective on that passage.
Yes, yeah. and the argument has been, yes, it's been made by a number of people, Murphy O'Connor as well.
It's kind of an Adam case. Christology, and we see that represented in Paul in a number of places, in 1 Corinthians and Romans as well.
Yes, yeah, but, he draws
but
the
that,
idea.
But that's not here, you don't think.
No. Well, if it is in the background, this is a digression, if it is in the background, I think it would come through the Prince of Tyre passage in Ezekiel, where you've got a pagan king who in many ways is like Adam, but he falls. So he starts well, but he falls in some sense. So I think if there is an allusion here to Adam, it's indirect. So it's not direct comparison between Christ and Adam. I think Paul, in Paul's mind, or whoever wrote this in their mind, you've got a number of Old Testament figures in the background, the King of Babylon, the Prince of Tyre, Antiochus Epiphanes, perhaps Herod in the New Testament, the man of lawlessness who takes his seat in the temple of God and sort of proclaims himself to be a god. These are the figures potentially in the background. I mean, so basically, let me sort of cut to the chase a little bit here. If he uses the phrase form of a god, I think it picks up on how either a pagan person or a post-pagan Christian might have looked on the human Jesus. Jesus in Galilee, Jesus in Judea. He had a godlike appearance. That would be the obvious sort of category to put him in if you were a pagan, not a Jew. And I'm not saying that Paul has invented, you know, a divine man thing,
right?
But it's looking through the eyes of a pagan, and I think you could argue, well, we might get onto the author, question the author, looking through pagan eyes, how would you describe Jesus? Well, he looks like you might imagine Heracles did, or someone like that, some divine man figure going around healing, declaring wise words, speaking wisdom, and so on.
Right. So when Paul says, or the author of this, if this is something, a preformed tradition, being in the form of God, kind of in the backdrop of that is all the divine man ideas. That is that Jesus was a healer, Jesus went about teaching. So it's interesting to me that Paul never mentions in any place the miracles of Jesus, I don't think.
Possibly not.
I mean, he's so focused on the exalted Christ often he doesn't say a lot about the earthly Jesus.
So, and this may not be Paul who wrote this.
Right, okay.
Certainly my argument is that this is coming from a pagan perspective, and I think it's probably more likely than not that someone other than Paul wrote this poetic piece. I call it an encomium rather than a hymn, because I think this is a piece in praise of a person rather than in worship of a god, which is effectively the distinction between an encomium and a hymn. Matthew Gordley has some quite interesting things to say in his book on that.
And these are not uncommon. Encomium are not uncommon in the ancient world.
No. So then you think of this less as Christology and more as rhetoric. So how do you praise Jesus from a pagan perspective? Mm-hmm. At least initially we're beginning from a pagan perspective. We end up, and this point has often been made, that there's not a particularly clear Jewish background to the first part of the encomium.
Right.
There's a very clear Jewish background to the second part. Mm-hmm. So let's use that idea that this is an encomium written initially from the point of view of a pagan or someone who's converted from a pagan faith to a Christian faith. So these are the categories that we begin to, you know, how we were beginning to understand the human Jesus, because this, you know, in the sense of let's fill in the backstory to our encounter with the risen Lord. So then I sort of use that to do something, so you can do something similar with this, as I said already, being like a god, being godlike, being equal to a god, being that. Language is frequently used in pagan literature and in the sort of the biblical, the Septuagint and so on. So someone who is thought of as being comparable to the gods, having a similar status to the gods. So then I mean, do you want me to keep going on
well,
this?
Well, I'm just thinking, as I'm thinking about it, you know, that to me would be a little more convincing if it didn't say being in the form of God as opposed to maybe appearing in the form. In other words, the participle, huparkon. I don't know that makes any difference, you know.
Well, because, I mean, you could look, I think sometimes the participle there is overinterpreted. It's used in some quite sort of commonplace contexts.
Yeah.
It doesn't in itself carry the, you know, some sort of
ontological,
ontological, Christological right necessarily. Right. It's a fair point.
I mean, because we use the term a couple of times, appearing, you know, these gods appeared. Yeah. And Paul uses that language that Jesus appears in 1 Corinthians 15, or was seen by, some would translate, was seen by these folks.
Yeah.
But clearly a focus on appearance, but that's after the resurrection and such. Well,
just to pick up on that, though,
sure.
I don't think this is saying that at a certain moment Jesus appeared in the way that a God might suddenly appear in human form on earth.
Mm.
It's more that he went around, he was throughout his ministry, throughout his career, in certain respects and from a certain point of view, he would have been godlike in appearance.
Particularly from a pagan perspective, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because Jews would have bristled, I think, with that.
Completely, yes. I mean, I think Mike Bird, in his recent book, Jesus Among the Gods, has some really interesting things to say along these lines. He doesn't come to the same conclusions. But when you start thinking of how Jesus would have been interpreted from a pagan point of view, where they are full of these stories of the gods, they're everywhere, and the statues of the gods, there's a lot of reflection on how well a statue reveals, the form of the statue reveals the being a person of a god, and these sort of things. So that's the appearance part. It's there in the word morphe. Because that it is so consistently
used
for external appearance.
External appearance. So it's inherent within the word itself. Appearance.
Yes.
Appearance of something, the outward appearance. Well, let's look at that second phrase. He did not consider, and this is the translation, did not count equality with God as a thing to be grasped. This is, again, the English Standard Version. And I think you use that. Is this the one you use in your book?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I tend to. Yeah.
It's interesting to me that the word God there, would you carry that through to say to be equal to a God? Because there's nothing there to necessarily tie in to being the one God of Israel.
I'm not sure it matters too much. I think it's more likely to have been heard as a reference to a sort of generic God figure rather than the particular God of Israel. It's being equal to being godlike, being equal to a god, and the harpagmos phrase, that's the critical part. And this is sort of where my research began, is just having gone through Roy Hoover's very influential essay on this.
In 1971, it was an early.
That's right.
Yeah, we'll put a reference to that in the show notes, a reference to that article. Yeah. Harvard Theological Review, as I recall.
Yes, HDR. I think so,
So... that was influential for you, and so kind of where have you ended up on this idea of harpagmos?
Okay, so Hoover's argument, and I didn't go through all the multiple interpretations that there are. I don't know how many did Tom Wright come up with for the expression. I mean, it's dozens. I just worked with Hoover because I think he's probably right in the interpretation of the idiom with harpagmos. To think of something as being something to be seized. All the examples that he looks at, a situation, some in sort of romantic literature from the period, the romance novels, from a later period, I mean, that's part of the problem, but they're all situations where someone is presented with an opportunity, various things, some from romance literature, some from the fathers and so on. So you're presented with an opportunity and you seize that opportunity or you don't. And effectively, he comes to that interpretation or translation of the expression, to seize an opportunity. But he then, and whether he noticed this or not, I don't know, but it then becomes holding on to something that you already have. And in a sense, yes, you do have it, but an opportunity is not something you've brought to the situation. An opportunity is something that someone else has presented. And the harpagmos, the harpazo verb, is important because you either take it or you don't. You know, my argument in the book is that this, what the incident behind this phrase is the temptation in the wilderness, when Jesus is presented with the opportunity to have kingdom over the nations of, in Luke, it's the oikoumene, in Matthew, it's the nations of the world. And that would be, in a sense, you have that authority, you become like Caesar. You have Caesar's authority or some other, you know, pagan ruler, whoever's in mind. And Jesus turns it down. He does not seize that opportunity when it's presented to him. Mm. Hoover and Tom Wright and many others have sort of took it as he already had this equality with God, but he didn't hold on to it. Wow. That idea is not in any of the examples, and there is only a limited number of examples, and Hoover really probably considers all of them, where this idiom is used. It's always an opportunity mm-hmm. presented rather mm-hmm. than a quality or characteristic resource that is owned, yeah. and therefore you decide whether to hang on to it or not.
So in this sort of poetic phrase, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped, the story behind that would be the story of the temptation.
Yes.
Would Paul have known that? Would he have known that story? Or, using this, let's say he wrote it or didn't write it, we don't know. But some have looked at this, by the way, as kind of a hymn, early Christian hymn. Mm-hmm. Others, I think Gordon Fee called it exalted prose.
Yeah.
You're looking at it as an encomium, a praise of a human figure, but a poem of praise to an exalted figure. But behind each one of these lines, there's sort of a story, it sounds like.
Yeah.
The appearance of a God, Jesus being offered the opportunity for the nations, but turning that down. But instead, he does stuff that's very ungodlike, doesn't he?
That's right. And so this emptied himself part.
Right. Yeah.
Which is sort of, that's as far as I really take the interpret the exegesis. Mm-hmm. The rest of it, I think, is relatively straightforward. Philo has an account of Moses leading the people out into the wilderness, from the cities into the wilderness, in order to empty their souls. It's mm-hmm. the same
kind same of, word, yeah.
The same idea. And specifically, I mean, I don't have the text in front of me, but he refers to rivalries, partisan attitudes, you know, to in order to get rid of wrong ideas of all civic life, perhaps, or political life in the cities, or something like that. I think it's quite possible. I don't think we can really sort of prove the point that actually there was a sort of a trope around of going out into the wilderness in order to empty yourself, perhaps. Mm. Or it may just be a coincidence that this has been picked up here, whatever. But that would tie in very well and help us to understand why Paul recounts this story in the form of an encomium, say, in order to address the selfish ambitions and vainglory of the Philippians. In Philo, it addresses exactly that language. So Jesus here is, I mean, Caseman had this problem of how you fit what this exalted Christological passage into paranesis of this form.
Yeah, exactly.
Into moral argument. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a tension there. I think I've sort of come to the conclusion that exalted Christological thing is not there. This is very much about how Jesus dealt with the temptations that come with having so much, the Son of God, empowered by the Spirit, offered by Satan, the rule over the kingdoms of the earth, but turning it down, and then learns in the wilderness how to pursue that path of obedience. Mm. And it's presented to the Philippians as a model for dealing with their own selfish ambition and glory. I mean, they said you learn humility.
Yeah.
So yes, as you said, there's a story, and so maybe this is a very condensed, intense, poetic version of a larger story that perhaps was being told. And we don't have access to that larger story in that form, so it's a little speculative.
Yeah, this is a fascinating reading, though. I mean, it really is. I'm excited that we're getting a chance to talk a little bit about it. Very quickly before we go, because our time is up again, verses 9 to 11, the second part of the hymn. In other words, you've told part of the story with verses 6 and 7, but the story continues.
Yeah.
And it becomes a very Jewish story, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Because all of a sudden now this God, the Hatheos, the God, super exalts him and bestows on him this name, right? And at the name of Jesus, which could be interpreted at the name which is Jesus or at the name that belongs to Jesus, I'm kind of in that second camp, every knee bows. And this language is taken right out of Isaiah 45. So this pagan story becomes a Jewish story pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Yes.
Seems like.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And that's where, because that's where Paul's going. So, I mean, he's
right.
You're taking the pagan mind or the new convert, taking them on a journey from how they might initially have perceived Jesus as a sort of godlike figure walking around Galilee and Judea and so on, to understanding the far-reaching eschatological significance of what came about subsequent to his humiliating death on a Roman cross. Yes. Every knee shall bow, every tongue confess. So, think about it. How was the pagan world going to be won over for the God of Israel? It's through the faithfulness, the obedience of the Son, who made this journey and was therefore exalted. And, I mean, the other point I think I would make, is it Jack Sanders who uses this cosmograph idea? And we're accustomed to thinking this as a sort of U-bend. Mm-hmm. So Jesus comes down and then goes up again.
Right, right.
That's the sort of traditional way of thinking about it. I think I'm coming to the conclusion that this is actually a very flat story. Mm. And it's all about reputation and appearance. So he begins in the form of a god. He appears to people as godlike. But he doesn't take the opportunity presented to him to take that shortcut to the kingdom that Satan offers him. And then he goes from being godlike in appearance to being clearly very human.
Right. And more faith, Thayu. More faith, Dulu, the form of a servant.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Or a slave, or, abject. Mm-hmm. The emphasis is all on appearances. The language of exaltation there, but it's not about raising some, that vertical thing. It's more about status. It's recognizing the new status that this person now has, which is why I think the emphasis there on a name, however we understand that name.
Right, yeah.
The focus is on name there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is an encomium I'm using the word hymn now, a poem of praise.
I've corrupted you somehow.
Yes, you have. A poem of praise about Jesus that focuses on how he is perceived, first by the pagans as a godlike figure, then as a nobody, and then they are coming to understand, and the people, the converts in Philippi have already grasped it. So their faith, it's faith in the future, a future when all the nations will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of Israel's God.
Mm. So ultimately to God's glory, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how this eschatological transformation is brought about.
And as you were saying earlier, this is, and I use the language here of Larry Hurtado, Jesus is presented as a kind of a lordly example, and as well as Paul later presents himself as an example, and Timothy and others, but here he begins with Jesus as this one who empties himself and says, be the same way as Jesus. And he's that example.
Yeah.
Fascinating book, Dr. Andrew Perriman. It's entitled In the Form of a God, The Preexistence of the Exalted Christ. You can find it at your friendly neighborhood theological library or on the line, I guess Amazon and other places sell it. But it's part of a series, new series, called Studies in Early Christology that I edit along with Mike Bird and Scott Hauer. Dr. Perriman, thanks for being with us today on The Stone Chapel.
No, thank you for the invitation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
If you learned too much today in the podcast, there is one guaranteed cure, and that is to share it with a friend. It'll take the pressure off the brain, okay? If you've never visited the amazing Lanier Theological Library, make plans to do it soon. We are growing. We're expanding. We've got a new presence over in Oxford, England. This is a place of solace and discovery. If you have comments for us or questions or just want to be in touch, contact us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. And thanks to all those who make this podcast possible. You know Until next week, thanks for listening.